Welcome, welcome, welcome. I'm your host, Henry Arslanian, and welcome to this episode of the Future Money Podcast. Before we start, I want to say a big thank you to really the 500,000 of you who follow my content each week. This podcast, The Future of Money, is now ranked in the top 5% of all podcasts globally on Spotify. Literally thousands of you from over 160 countries globally are tuning in each week to listen about the future of money and the future of finance. So really a big, big, big thank you from the bottom of my heart. As all you loyal listeners know, my goal with this podcast is very simple. It's really to go deep in some of the biggest ideas, trends, and developments we are seeing in the field of crypto, and hopefully empower you with this information and then let you make your own decision on what their impact could be on the future of money and finance. Today, I'm very excited because I'm joined by Philip Baghazi, who's the founder and CEO of XBTO. I think many of you have discovered XBTO recently with the jersey sponsorship of the Miami team, and I will talk about that as well later with Phil. But Phil, I'm very excited to talk about market movements, what we're seeing, what's going to happen post ETF approval, what's happening in the field of crypto derivatives, market making, a lot of interesting topics. Phil Baghazi, welcome on the Future Money Podcast.
Thanks, Henry. Good to be here.
Great to have you on board. You know, I always, every time we have a guest, I like to mention something interesting about them. I think that the interesting story here is how you and I met. My father-in-law and your father are friends. As I always say to Phil, half jokingly, I think none of them understand what we do in life. But it's one of the random things. I've never had my father-in-law and somebody's father be friends, and that's how we connected. So small world, all roads lead to crypto, I guess.
Indeed. Yeah, it's good to hear. I did not know. And so here we are.
Here we go. That's the way to do it. Phil, so a lot of things to start. Before we start discussing the topics in depth, would you mind sharing with your audience about your personal background, how you started from your hedge fund days to what you do with XBTO? Also share with our audience, what is XBTO and what do you guys do?
I've spent about half of my life in, let's just say, the traditional world of traditional finance, and about half of my life in the sort of digital assets world, crypto world, as we call it. It's about 20 years of my career. Started at a hedge fund in the early 2000s at a hedge fund called Point72. People know it also as SAC Capital. It's focused more on global macro strategies. Looked at all the products that you can imagine in a hedge fund that does global macro, credit derivatives. It was the beginning of credit derivatives back in the day. You know, FX derivatives, equity derivatives, all that jazz we were looking at as, you know, places as far as Australia, Kiwi, you know, Brazil, Mexico, everywhere. And then I left shortly before the crisis and went to do some consulting for banks and hedge funds in the technology and in sort of risk management for derivatives specifically. And so I traveled the world. I wanted to travel the world. I wanted to get out of being, you know, in front of a screen. And that was really eye-opening. Shortly after a couple of years, in the early 2010, fell down that rabbit hole that we called, you know, Bitcoin, and started thinking about, hey, this is amazing technology. I want to do something with it. It wasn't until 2015 that I decided that I would bring all of my experience, technology and finance, and focus it on providing better liquidity on exchanges around the world, right? So in the US, in Europe, in Japan, in China, anywhere we found that liquidity was lacking and that we had an edge, we would deploy our algos. We were completely quant driven. It was completely systematic. We barely used any of the bank rails. And that's what really made us, I think, quite successful in the early days, was that it was very hard to move money around. And so the only thing that
I remember those days very well.
Right? I mean, it was even hard to get a bank account, to be honest. So we started out with, you know, just moving the underlier, which was Bitcoin, around, and that was our collateral. And we did very, very well. And from there, we branched out in venture capital. We have a corporate venture fund that we've deployed funds into things that we thought was important in the ecosystem, like, you know, crypto options, like crypto accounting, regulatory, technology, AI, anything that we thought kind of could impact digital assets and made our life easier, we wanted to invest in. So that's what we did. And now we have an asset management with other people's money. Yeah, we started out as being our own prop trading as a prop trading company. I'm focused on our own funds. And now we're sort of turning this around after 90 years of experience. We're kind of like, we've got all this risk management experience going through all these bear markets and bull markets, having built a real robust risk management platform. We've decided that, hey, we think we're ready now. And I think the world is ready. You know, the admins, the auditors. Back in the day, you couldn't really do it in 2015. It was very difficult to do. Nobody had the ability to really do it in any particular way. And of course, crypto can change very fast and you need to be nimble and flexible. Otherwise, you can't take advantage of the opportunity. So what's the point, you know, to be in a structure that you really can't create any alpha for investors. So now we feel like very comfortable with that. We have a fund that we launched about a year ago that's done very well. Actually, our best month was during the FTX crash. You know, we've added a lot of people. We're about 80 people worldwide. Just hired our chief commercial officer from Goldman, spent 13 years plus there in wealth management, quantitative solutions. So really building the platform. And we're really excited. There's so much, you know, going on, and we're, you know, with the coming of the ETF, it's going to be something else, I think.
It's interesting what you mentioned. You know, I've been in the space as long as you are, and I still remember those early days where actually banks were not even forgetting about opening an account. If they knew that as a founder, you're involved in crypto, they would literally close your account with 30-day notice. And I think the number of businesses and lives that have been ruined by some of these, the banks, I think it's something one day we'll look back at this. And I think they're... you know, it is what it is now. But you just mentioned, Phil, I want to touch a couple of things. So you mentioned in your introduction. Let's start about the before we talk about ETF, about the infrastructure, right? When you look at the crypto ecosystem today, what do you think that the missing parts of the ecosystem that are still missing that you think, if enabled, would really further catalyze the entry of institutional players?
So I think what we've seen in pretty much since the beginning of Bitcoin was that there was two school of thoughts, right? There's the school of thought of you're your own custodian and you will hold your crypto in your own wallet. And effectively, your counterparty risk is yourself. You know, you lose your crypto, you forget about your private key, whatever, you know, you have a boating accident. And then there's the sort of centralized way of saying, hey, I'm going to entrust my keys to a centralized exchange, and they're going to look after my Bitcoin or my Ethereum, as it may be. The exchanges have evolved from being bulletin boards to being kind of basic, you know, websites to more sophisticated exchanges that do custody in a certain way. And what we're witnessing now is the need for separation of duties, right? Where conflicts of interest are quite, at least, if not separated, disclosed in a very regulated and transparent way. And that's going to be critical, right? As you go into doing more into derivatives, right? Structured products, options had a great year, right? Volumes in anything else but options were kind of down, but options held up. That means that institutions or sophisticated players stayed in the game more so than retail. And so, you know, a clearinghouse seems like would be the next step forward in this sort of centralized way of dealing and trading with cryptocurrencies. And so we're working on things like this where, you know, priming the ability to trade on one exchange versus another and get capital relief, marginal relief, automatic, you know, settlement of capital calls, of margin calls. All this is very important, I think, going forward, right? We can't really operate the way we've operated in the past. There's too many risks.
But I would argue, Phil, I mean, in many regards, the state of crypto custody has evolved greatly, I mean, from the early days. I mean, to many extent right now, if you look, I think, the last 12 to 44 months, the crypto custody offerings we have, not only from traditional custody, but also solutions like Clearloop and what Comenio is doing and others that offer this kind of bridge, if you want, have been quite interesting. I think you're right. There's a massive gap when it comes to prime brokerage and being able to use margin. And I think it's interesting the idea of clearinghouses as well with options and especially some of the pickup on the activity side. I just want to touch on this point as well. So when you look at the state right now of crypto derivatives, right? Let's talk about options first, and we could talk about perps and after what's happening after. When you look at the space right now of crypto options, where do you think we are in the evolution of it? Because if you look at it, there's obviously some offshore centralized exchanges. There's all the CME trading that's happening. Where do you think we are heading? First, do you think there's a lot of upside when it comes to crypto options? And what do you think, again, is missing? Is it a clearinghouse? Is it bigger players? What do you think is missing for the crypto derivative space to grow, especially when it comes to options?
The issue with derivatives is more about regulation. And because options involve leverage, being clear that the risk management of such exchange or clearinghouse is adequate to, you know, deal with a very volatile underlier. Bitcoin is quite volatile. And when you have a lot of leverage on an already volatile, you know, asset, it compounds the risks. I think right now we are in a position where, you know, Deribit's market leader. They are offshore exchange, but they are looking to be, of course, you know, fully regulated, fully audited, and they've shown that they've been able to sustain the times. Actually, we are, you know, we're an investor in Deribit, a fairly significant one. We started in 2016, 2017, and it was crickets back there. We were 90% of the flow. And then as time went on, we became smaller and smaller players in that exchange. And so I think what will happen going forward is that as things get more clear and regulated, at least in physical options, because of course the ETF will have its own options stream, the strip, right? At least in physical options, I believe that the addition of, you know, the companies that you mentioned, the sort of custody solution, whether it be Fireblocks or Clearloop or Stablehouse, that get the, you know, sort of the coins off of the exchange in a place where you have more, you feel like you have more control, or you maybe have more trust in that entity because maybe there's maybe a little less conflicts of interest. I think all that are very great steps. The next step really is about priming and getting capital efficiency, especially when it comes to bilateral options, like for example, broken dates, or you know, you want to hedge a specific date or a specific point, a specific strike. You know, who do you call and how does that entity, you know, hedge itself, right? And it's very challenging today to do it. You know, it's very operationally heavy. It's a lot of margining that you have to manage. So having a sort of central, it could be technology, it could be a technological layer, but at the end of the day, it has to be something that gives you the opportunity to say, hey, I'm long a call here and I'm short the same call here. In reality, my margin should be close to zero, maybe a little bit of counterparty risk here and there. But that's critical, and that's coming. And I'm very excited about it. I think it's with the addition of the ETF, there's going to be enormous flows coming into the market.
What do you think is the prospect then on the cash settled options market, the CME and the likes of, what do you think was going to happen to that market?
Well, I think there's a space for it. I think they're going to continue growing. It's just that there's a lot less leverage and there are a lot less market participants that are able to get exposure to it, right? The CME is the big boys club, right? It's mostly large institution. You got to kind of be qualified. So $5 million and up. You know, you're going to have to go through an FCM that can service you in those products. And so it's a little bit of a smaller market at the end of the day. But if you're a U.S. institution, that's the only game in town. That's where you're going to go, right?
Yeah, so I think it is what it is. I think it's interesting your point of view with the ETF. Before I talk about other types of derivatives, I just want to – you mentioned the ETF a couple of times now, right? So obviously there's a lot of – by the time we're October 27, we're recording this, there's obviously a lot of rumors. Bitcoin has had a great rally last couple of weeks, a couple of days because of many alleged because of this news. What do you think is going to be the impact? Let's say if and when, first of all, do you believe there'll be a Bitcoin ETF that will be approved? I presume yes, on the physical side. But once it happens, what do you think is going to be the impact it can have, not only to allowing retail to come in, but on the broader market infrastructure?
Look, I think this is the ultimate step in creating liquidity for Bitcoin. We saw it in previous commodities, gold in the 80s. When an ETF was announced, the price of that commodity went up quite dramatically. That is going to be pretty similar, I think, for Bitcoin. Maybe maybe to a lesser degree in the sense that, hey, getting access to gold was kind of cumbersome back in the 80s, maybe. And so an ETF was really like, okay, yeah, now really can get exposure to gold. You know, Bitcoin, you can go to a Coinbase or to a stable house or to any other exchange and get access to the physical Bitcoin. But I think there are a lot of entities, institutions that cannot put Bitcoin or other crypto assets on their balance sheet for either accounting reasons, tax reasons, regulatory reasons, compliance reasons. And I think the ability to get an ETF that is a spot ETF, which means that it has much more capacity than one of those futures ETF that you have right now on the trade, right? There are some ETFs right now on futures, but they have idiosyncratic issues. You know, they can trade at a premium, discount, anyway. So spot ETF, I think, is the ultimate product for certain pension funds, certain institutions to get access to it, even maybe like potentially banks, because it fits nicely operationally into their sort of product life cycle, right? They know how to distribute it. They know how to deal with it. They know how it's taxed. And so it's a lot of transparency and it's familiar. It's a familiar product.
Yeah, and I agree with you, Phil. But let's say the counter argument to this point is, if you look, I mean, there's been physical Bitcoin ETFs in Canada, for example, for some time, similar ETP or similar products in Europe and other Scandinavian, other parts of the world. I mean, if technically you think a US advisor wanted to recommend a Bitcoin ETF, you think it has to be in the US. It has to be US listed. It won't be a Canadian one. It's not good enough, right? So that fact has a material impact on the volumes that can come in the market, in your opinion.
Yeah, 100%. I think it has to be dollar denominated. First of all, it cannot be Canadian or something synthetic. Cannot be Euro. And you know, you can look at basically, if you're a company around the world and you want to go an IPO, your first protocol is like, I want to IPO in the US because it's the deepest liquidity, the deepest capital markets. That's where you're going to get your best multiples. And in a way, it's sort of similar to with an ETF, right?
No, I think it's a very fair point there. I just want to talk about the other world of crypto derivatives, right? Which I think a lot of listeners we've had on our show in the past talk about the space, but with, let's say, perpetual swaps, right? Which is these kind of derivatives that never settle in a way. What do you think is the landscape there? I mean, do you expect to see, I think, as we all know, the volume globally of derivatives compared to spot in traditional markets is multiple times bigger, right? When it comes to crypto derivatives, right, so we discussed options a couple of minutes ago. When it comes to, let's say, perpetual swaps, what do you think is needed? First, are you seeing a lot of interest from institutional investors on trading that, or it's a lot of retail punters? But also, what do you think will take for proper institutional players to come and enter the perps space, as we call it?
Perpetual swap is a crypto product, really. I mean, in other traditional assets, we'd call it a CFD, a contract for difference, or something like that, right? We think it's a great product because people in general don't like to deal with the life cycle of a product, right? If they want to go long, they want to be able to go long forever, and they don't want to have to worry about, oh, it's expiring next Thursday at 10 a.m., I'm going to have to roll it. At least retail doesn't want to have to deal with it. Now, it's a weird product because, of course, it has to be indexed. It has a funding that can move dramatically, right? So you got to pay attention to that. A lot of people don't pay attention to it. They want the convenience of what a perp swap gives them for speculative reasons. But you have to be kind of careful that you're not overpaying in terms of funding. Institutions definitely want leverage. I mean, 100%. If you can work with other people's money, and effectively that's what you end up doing, right? Then you should. It all comes down to what is your cost of funds. How much are you paying to get the opportunity or the ability to leverage yourself 5x or 10x? I think institutional definitely, there's a lot of demand for us for CFDs mainly. Like, can you make us a market? Also because we're a regulated entity and they're like, well, we can't really touch any of these other entities right now because they're not regulated. They're not transparent. They're not audited and this and that. So could you give us a synthetic performance to another product that's out there? And yeah, for sure. It's really interesting. And we have these conversations quite often.
It's very interesting. I think you're right. I mean, that the product is such a unique product, actually, when it comes to the crypto space, you know, so it is what it is. I mean, one other thing I want to touch upon, I mean, from an XBTO perspective, is the whole market making space, right? There's been obviously massive changes in the post-FTX world, post-SEC enforcements against some of the big market makers in the US. When you look at it from your vantage point, right, as a firm who deals with regulated institutions outside of the US, how do you see the state of crypto market making? And how do you think is it different from market making in traditional finance?
So we've been doing market making since 2015. And the key issue that we faced when you're doing market making on exchanges that are, some are regulated, some are not regulated, is that you have significant counterparty risk. So you have to take into account the fact that, and especially back in the day, but look, at the end of the day, it still happens. So you still have to think that way in certain ways. How much of my capital am I going to dedicate to a strategy to make a market in any exchanges, right? So you sort of, you have a portfolio of exchanges that you're working with. You don't want to put all your eggs in the same basket. You want to diversify your exchanges, and then you want to use those different exchanges and, you know, play them against each other, right? I mean, that would be cross-exchange arbitrage. And you can do that cross-products, right? Futures versus spot, futures versus futures of another exchange, or even like options versus futures, things like that. So it has evolved since 2015 because products have evolved. There's a lot more tokens right now. There are things that are really illiquid, where making a market is fairly challenging, where you're taking a different kind of risk. And there are things that are more liquid, where you can hedge yourself more easily. So all of these things come into play. And what we're trying to do is to make sure that we have a product for pretty much any of these different scenarios, right? So if you have a new token that's coming to market, it's a nice, effectively an ICO, it's never been traded anywhere. How do we make a market on something that's so novel, where, you know, and so we have, you know, solutions for that. And then we have solutions for Bitcoin and Ethereum, which are much more deeper markets. And we're happy to make markets for any exchange anywhere in the world for those bellwether cryptos.
It's interesting how the landscape is going to change. I mean, the whole ecosystem, it's interesting because, I mean, I don't know if you'd agree with me, but before, literally, two years ago, I mean, a lot of the big market makers are all in the US, and now there's been a massive shift from that perspective. How do you see it when you look at the crypto at a global perspective right now, Philip? And are you seeing, you know, the shift out going out of the US? Do you think it's here to stay? Do you think it's driving away the center of balance of crypto? Or you think the US market will become dominant again in crypto in the coming years when governments change, policymakers change, and whatnot?
Well, things will change. I think right now it's very difficult to be innovative in the U.S. because anytime you take a little bit of a risk, you get slapped and very meaningfully. But right now, it's really the SEC that's being quite aggressive, and you have seen certain cases. But the SEC is not really providing any, you know, transparency into how they're thinking about it. They're not guiding. They're not regulating, and so they're just basically enforcing. And I don't want to play that game personally. I have no interest in that. That's just, you know, maybe some people would like that. But I think over the years, it's become more and more complicated to do anything in the U.S. Yeah, you know, and so I think people are being pushed ashore. And there's this concept of security versus a utility that is quite US-centric. I mean, certain jurisdictions have this difference between the two, but it's really the US that really pushes this sort of like, oh, this could be a security, Ethereum could be a security. And then you're like, oh, well, wow. I mean, excuse me, but, you know, it's taxed in a certain way that's not a security. There's so many issues that go on with crypto that are not being clarified over the years, that at the end of the day, you're really taking a big risk being in the US, which is really too bad. Because I think that the U.S. has, again, the deepest capital markets in the world, and it should be, you know, Silicon Valley should be the one that should be pushing things forward. And in recent times, it really has not.
I mean, you're actually based in Bermuda. XBTO is licensed there. I mean, can you share us why Bermuda, and what do you like about Bermuda? Like, what should our listeners, I know many of them run crypto companies or they're in the space, what should they know about Bermuda and its crypto initiatives?
Well, Bermuda was one of the first jurisdictions to have clear rules on crypto assets, right? Through the Digital Asset Business Act in 2018. I had the chance to meet with the government before 2018 in New York, and they said, hey, you know, we're thinking about doing something in digital assets. Can you help us? Would you move? What would it take for us to bring you to our shores? And I thought this was a great idea because, you know, New York was BitLicense. It was very, very regulated. And we were a prop trading firm, but so we didn't really offer any solutions at that time. But people would not deal with us because we were in New York. So we're like, if we're going to stay in this space, we're going to have to be in a much more, in a clear jurisdiction that's friendlier to both us and to our counterparties. So I worked on the legislation with the government, and we were one of the first entities licensed in Bermuda. And we have two licenses, FPTO and Stable House. One's a market maker, investment manager, and the other one is custodian. And we've recently put them together because we thought that there was a lot of advantage to doing that. But yeah, so I think Bermuda is a great place. It's, you know, there's a lot of clarity in everything that you can do. You can innovate without feeling like you're going to end up in a dark cell somewhere.
Yeah. which is very good. I mean, you know, I had the privilege as well with meeting many people in the Bermudan government. I mean, many actually crypto companies operated there. It's quite interesting on that perspective as well. I remember back in the day, we used to go a lot to Bermuda. It was one of the few places with no Zika as well. So this was when Zika was a thing.
It's close to the, it's 2 hours from New York, 2 hours from Miami.
Yeah.
It's fairly similar time zones.
Exactly.
So the insurance and reinsurance industry, it's very, very strong here in Bermuda. So that's actually a very key component of crypto going forward, is how do you insure all this crypto, right? So then you can create ecosystem. You have a very cool ecosystem that you can leverage.
Absolutely. Phil, we're literally almost out of time. I need to ask you one last question before we move to the fire round. Obviously, you guys sponsored Inter Miami a couple of years ago from a football soccer perspective. Let me use the right term for our American audience. I mean, it's interesting for me because I've known XBTO for many years. And since the Messi move, I mean, I'm seeing the XBTO logo everywhere. Like, could you share from your perspective, like, what was the genesis behind this Miami sponsorship? But really, the impact that Messi has had on the XBTO brand for your business and globally?
You know, I say it very often. I mean, we're so proud to be their sponsor, and it so happened that it was a confluence of events that made it such that it made sense for us to be there, the first partner on the jersey and the first MLS crypto sponsor, right? So as a series of firsts, you know, having moved to Miami, being like, hey, we're here in Miami, what can we do? It was in May 2021, the market was quite strong, and we were like, can we do something that makes a difference, that's big? I like to do things that really matter, not being a small little sponsor. You know, you barely see what's the point of that. So I've always been about like, hey, if we're going to do this, let's do it big. And, you know, we were approached by Inter Miami. I had the chance to talk to David Beckham and the ownership team and the guys. I really connected with the guys having grown up in Paris. You know, I had this connection with what I'll call football, but, soccer. And they call it football down in Miami because of the Latin influence. But, yeah, it was like it made so much sense. So it ended up being an amazing trade. And Messi joining just made it even much bigger. You see the jersey everywhere in the world. It's what we'll call it. It's not origination for us. It's validation, right, for the brand. So it's not like you're getting a ton of fans, you know, trying to onboard to XPTO because we don't really have anything for them, right? But in terms of validation, you know, dealing with counterparties anywhere in the world, whether they be in Brazil, Argentina, Japan, well, they know XPTO because it's like, oh, it's messy, you know? So it's kind of cool from that perspective.
Probably the best ROI of any sponsorship I've seen. We've had many CMO crypto companies on the show. But this is one that's going to go down in the history books of sponsorship.
We certainly hope so.
Well, Phil, we're going to finish up with a traditional fire round of questions. I have my bell here to keep us honest. So I'm going to ask you quick questions. I want one or two word quick answers. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Phil, you spend a lot of time, you live in Bermuda. What's your favorite thing about Bermuda?
The weather.
Well, of course. You also spend a lot of time in Miami. What's your favorite thing about Miami?
The soccer.
There we go. I was expecting that. There's a lot of people, you've been in this space. XBTO was founded in 2015. You met a lot of people over the years. Who is the craziest person you met over the years in our industry?
Oh, wow. The craziest person I've ever met is There's so many crazy people in this industry. I mean, that's a really tough question, I gotta say, without naming anyone. I'm one of those crazy people sometimes.
Here we go. Sam Bankman-Fried gives you a call from wherever he is right now, wherever he will be. What's the one thing you tell to SBF?
Good luck. Good luck.
If you were a betting man, who is Satoshi and where he or she is from?
I think he is probably not with us anymore. I think he is from an English-speaking native country. And I think it probably started with one person, but potentially could have been a group of people.
Interesting. What's the most difficult thing in launching crypto business?
Everything is hard. Compliance, risk management.
Yep.
Raising money, getting a bank.
You hire a lot of people over the years, right? You guys have over 80, 90 people now. What is the one skill you wish more people in crypto have or had when you're hiring?
A better understanding of traditional finance. And we do hire a lot from traditional finance, but, you know, sort of risk management, how things kind of equate, because a lot of things equate. There's not a lot of, you don't need to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's something I see as well. Next one, what advice you would give to anyone looking at getting into the crypto industry?
Focus on history, meaning don't go for necessarily the new shiny thing. Try to look at things that have existed for a while, understand it, and then position yourself in it first, right? Put a market position. That would be Bitcoin or Ethereum at this rate. Because, you know, there's a lot going on, NFTs and that are dangerous, that have this allure of that you can make money very quickly, but unfortunately, not really proven.
You could hire any traditional hedge fund manager as your intern. Which hedge fund manager would you hire as your intern?
Jim Simons.
Oh, here we go. Where is that, by the way? Short side?
I think he's done amazingly well.
Commodity side, yeah.
Yeah, over the decades, and it's very similar to the things that we do, and a lot of quant and systematic work, and I love his book.
No, exactly. I think it's many of his books actually. It's interesting views on crypto as well, but that's for different podcasts. And Phil Begazza, thanks for joining us today, CEO and founder of XBTO. The last question, a traditional question of anybody on my show, Phil. If you could have lunch or dinner with one person dead or alive, who would you have lunch or dinner with?
And I'd have lunch with you, man.
Let's we'll have do to it. Our meal,
I'll
but
be in Dubai sometime.
Here we go. That's what we're looking for. Phil, it was a pleasure having you on the show today. If people want to get in touch with you, learn more about you or XBTO, where can they find out more information?
XBTO.com or my Twitter, Philippe Beck, XBTO at XBTO Group also. And we're on LinkedIn also quite a bit. We're active, so you can subscribe to the XBTO group LinkedIn page. Thank you.
Well, Phil, thanks for being on the show. Kind of thanks, guys, everybody. Hope this was a useful show. Again, if you like the content, make sure to give that 5-star review. It really helps more people discover the show. And also to make sure to check out our YouTube page as well, where we have a lot of these exclusive content that is also there. You can see actually how Phil and I look in person as well that you can on the podcast from that perspective. Guys, thank you very much. It was great having you guys on the show. Thank you very much. And see you all soon for another episode of the Future Money Podcast. Thank you.